A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been replacing his disintegrating IKEA storage with industrial Euro boxes from a place called Yossi Box near Ashdod, and the move has him thinking about the sustainability angle. The cool question is, if you need heavy-duty storage, ready for serious weight, what are the more sustainable material directions? Are there intermediate options between standard polypropylene and full stainless steel that are less environmentally damaging, but can still handle the loads? Let's dig into this. And more broadly, what does sustainability even look like in industrial storage right now?
And the first thing to say is that the sustainability conversation around industrial storage is almost completely backwards in consumer-facing coverage. And Daniel's experience with the IKEA stuff failing at unpredictable loads. That's not just his bad luck. That's the fundamental design trade-off in consumer storage.
The warping drawer of doom.
The actual environmental calculus on industrial storage containers is a lot more nuanced, and in some scenarios, the polypropylene Eurobox comes out ahead of the alternatives. The Eurobox system Daniel's talking about is the VDA 4500 standard, sometimes called the KLT system, originated in the German automotive industry in the 1980s. Your gut is doing what most people's guts do, which is confusing material identity with environmental impact. Here's the thing. A standard Euro container. Let's take the 600 by 400 millimeter footprint, which is the most common. A typical polypropylene version weighs somewhere around 2 to 3 kilograms.
It's the shipping container principle applied to the inside of your house.
And like shipping containers, the standard is what creates the ecosystem. Daniel mentioned dollies. Those are standardized to the 600 by 400 footprint. Shelving systems are built around it. And that mass has to be mined, refined, transported, formed, and eventually dealt with at end of life. The embodied energy in that steel box is vastly higher before it ever holds a single item.
The Rectangle Treaty. Signed in blood by German automotive engineers.
The actual recovery depends entirely on the waste stream infrastructure where the box ends its life. The VDA 4500 spec defines dimensions, stacking geometry, and load-bearing requirements. It does not mandate polypropylene. So in theory, anything that meets the dimensional and mechanical spec can enter the ecosystem.
And in practice?
That number comes from a recent industry analysis I was reading, and it's genuinely grim. These boxes are expected to survive thousands of stacking cycles, forklift impacts, temperature swings from freezing warehouses to hot loading docks, UV exposure if they're stored outdoors, and chemical exposure depending on what's in them. It's a recycling aspiration with a few pilot programs attached, but here's where the industrial storage context flips the analysis. Industrial Euro boxes don't typically enter the post-consumer waste stream the way a yogurt tub does.
Because they're not being thrown out by households.
They live in closed or semi-closed industrial loops. A logistics company buys 10,000 Euro boxes, uses them for years, often a decade or more, and when they finally reach end of life, they're typically being retired in bulk from a known location. And most of these boxes, when they finally crack or warp beyond usability, they go to landfill or incineration.
Because recycling industrial plastics is harder than it sounds.
Post-industrial recycling exists and works reasonably well. If you're a manufacturer with clean, single-stream polypropylene scrap, that gets reground and fed back into production. But post-consumer or post-use recycling of these containers is a mess. The boxes often have metal reinforcements, RFID tags, adhesive labels, paint markings, chemical residues from whatever they stored. Sorting and cleaning all of that to get back to food grade or even industrial grade recycled polypropylene is expensive and energy intensive. There was a study out of Fraunhofer Institute a few years back that found the effective recycling rate for industrial rigid plastics in Europe was hovering around 30%, and that was the optimistic estimate.
The boxes last a decade, then become landfill for centuries.
That's the shape of the problem, and Daniel's intuition. I'd rather not use plastic if I had a choice. That's where the material science conversation gets genuinely interesting. What else could you make a Eurobox out of?
Let's go through the candidates. He mentioned stainless steel for the really heavy stuff.
Right, and stainless is the gold standard for extreme environments. Food processing, pharmaceutical, anywhere you need to autoclave or pressure wash with harsh chemicals, rated to 80 kilos and beyond. But stainless steel has an enormous embodied carbon cost: mining, smelting, alloying. The carbon footprint per kilogram is roughly 6 to 10 times that of polypropylene. And the weight means shipping costs, and fuel consumption go up across the entire logistics chain. A stainless Euro container weighs maybe 5 or 6 kilos empty versus under a kilo for the equivalent plastic box. Over thousands of shipments, that weight penalty compounds.
Stainless is the "I need this to survive a bomb blast" option, not the sustainability play.
Unless your definition of sustainability is purely about longevity and you ignore the upfront carbon cost, which some life cycle analyses actually do favor for certain use cases. If a stainless box lasts 50 years and replaces 20 plastic boxes that would have been landfilled, the math can work out. But that's a very specific scenario.
What about aluminum?
Aluminum has the same weight problem as steel, roughly, and its primary production is even more carbon intensive. Recycled aluminum is better, but you're still dealing with a material that dents easily and doesn't have the chemical resistance of polypropylene for many applications. There are niche aluminum Euro containers for electronics and aerospace, but they're not a general purpose solution.
Metals are out for the mainstream case. What about wood?
Wood is actually more interesting than it sounds. There are companies in Europe making Euro dimension containers out of pressed wood fiber, plywood, and even engineered bamboo composites. The carbon storage angle is appealing. Wood sequesters carbon rather than emitting it during production. And at end of life, it's biodegradable in a way plastic isn't. But wood containers have real limitations. They're heavier than plastic, though lighter than steel. They absorb moisture, which means they can warp, swell, or grow mold in humid environments. Their load ratings top out around 20 to 30 kilos for a standard size box, which is fine for light industrial but doesn't touch the 50 plus kilo ratings of heavy duty polypropylene.
Wood is porous, so you can't use it for anything that might leak or need to be washed down.
Food storage, chemical storage, anything involving liquids. Wood fails on hygiene requirements. So wood Euro boxes exist, and they're a viable option for dry goods in climate controlled environments. Daniel moving his home office gear into wood boxes would probably work fine, but they're not a drop-in replacement across the board.
The other obvious candidate is recycled plastic. If the problem is virgin polypropylene, why not just use recycled?
This is where the industry is actually moving fastest. Several major European manufacturers, Auer Packaging, SSI Schaefer, a few others, now offer Euro containers made from what they call post-industrial recycled polypropylene, or PIRPP. Some are pushing into post-consumer recycled as well, though the quality control is harder. The challenge is that recycled polypropylene has shorter polymer chains than virgin material. Each melt cycle degrades the molecular structure a bit, which reduces impact resistance and load-bearing capacity. A container made from 100% recycled PP might only handle 60 or 70% of the rated load of its virgin equivalent.
You're trading environmental virtue for structural integrity.
At the margins, yes, but the manufacturers are getting clever about this. Some are using a co-injection molding process where the core of the wall is recycled material and the outer skin is virgin. You get the strength where you need it, at the surface, and the recycled content where it doesn't compromise performance. Others are blending recycled PP with glass fiber reinforcement to bring the strength back up. A 30% glass-filled recycled polypropylene can match or exceed the mechanical properties of unfilled virgin PP.
So now we're mixing materials, which presumably makes end-of-life recycling even harder.
You're way ahead of me. Yes, glass fiber reinforced plastics are notoriously difficult to recycle because the fibers are embedded in the polymer matrix. You can't just melt it down and separate them. The composite recycling problem is one of the thorniest in material science right now. So you might get a longer service life and reduced virgin material use, but you're creating something that's essentially unrecyclable at end of life. It's a trade-off, not a solution.
This is the thing about sustainability questions. Every answer spawns three more problems.
That's before we even get to bioplastics.
I was waiting for bioplastics to enter the chat.
food processing, pharmaceutical, anywhere you need to pressure wash containers regularly, or where you can't risk plastic particle shedding. But for general dry goods storage, the upfront cost premium keeps most buyers in plastic.
Is anyone making Euroboxes from recycled aluminum specifically?
There are a few European manufacturers doing it. The aluminum extrusion and sheet metal industry has been using high percentage recycled content for decades. It's just economically sensible because virgin aluminum is so energy intensive. So most aluminum Euroboxes on the market are already made from significant recycled content, even if it's not marketed as a green product. The material economics have baked that in for years. It shatters under impact rather than deforming, which is exactly what you don't want in a container that gets knocked around warehouses and trucks. And that brings me to what I think is the most underexplored material direction for industrial storage, which is natural fiber reinforced composites.
Okay, you've got my attention. What kind of fibers?
Hemp, flax, jute, and increasingly agricultural waste fibers like wheat straw and rice husk. The idea is, you use these natural fibers as reinforcement in a polymer matrix, typically polypropylene, ironically, to reduce the total polymer content while maintaining or improving mechanical properties. There's a company called Danimer Scientific that's been scaling up PHA production, but they're mostly targeting single-use packaging, not durable goods. The industrial storage application just isn't there yet at competitive prices.
The bioplastic story is, check back in 10 years.
The composite is still a plastic at end of life, but the per unit fossil carbon footprint is lower.
The plant fibers themselves are carbon that was pulled out of the atmosphere during growth. There's a sustainability argument for industrial storage that isn't about the material at all. It's about not throwing away the whole shelf every 3 years.
In a warehouse environment with humidity swings, a hemp-filled PP box can absorb moisture and lose some dimensional stability over time. An industrial Euro container that costs 3 times as much but lasts 15 years, you've used one container instead of 7 or 8. Even if both are virgin polypropylene, the industrial path uses less plastic over time. It's a deal-breaker if not managed. The Euro Container Standard, which is the DIN and ISO standard that governs all of this, specifies pretty tight dimensional tolerances.
The fast fashion of home storage.
That's exactly the right framing. The consumer storage market is optimized for low upfront cost and planned obsolescence. Nobody expects a Kallax to survive a move. It's furniture as semi-disposable infrastructure. The prompt mentioned this. The genius is in the interoperable standard. That's not an overstatement.
Which brings us back to the standard, the interoperability Daniel was excited about.
The 600 by 400 millimeter footprint is designed to fit perfectly on a 1200 by 800 millimeter Euro pallet. A box that spent 10 years carrying engine parts in a BMW factory can get a second life carrying inventory in a small business, then a third life storing Christmas decorations in someone's attic. 4 boxes per layer, perfectly tessellated. And the heights are modular too, so different heights stack on each other without gaps. The dollies are standardized. The shelving is standardized.
The sloth approach to storage. Slow, steady, reuse everything.
It's honestly the most underappreciated sustainability mechanism in the whole sector. Standardization enables reuse. That's the hard constraint that a lot of material science enthusiasm runs into. You can't just swap materials and assume the system still works. The Euro Container Standard doesn't specify material, by the way.
If Daniel's core question is, what's the most sustainable way to do heavy-duty storage? The first answer might be, buy used Euro containers and use them until his grandchildren inherit them.
That's a defensible answer. But let me complicate it slightly. The used container market is mostly polypropylene and HDPE. If his environmental concern is specifically about plastic, about petrochemical extraction, about microplastic shedding, about the fundamental fact of fossil-derived materials, then buy used plastic is harm reduction, not harm elimination. The plastic still exists. It'll still eventually become moist. You've just delayed the endpoint and amortized the impact over more years of service.
What's the option for someone who wants the standardization and durability, but actively wants to avoid plastic?
This is where we get into what I'd call the intermediate materials Daniel was asking about. And there are a few that are interesting, though none are perfect.
Walk me through them.
First candidate, molded pulp. This is essentially thick, compressed paper fiber. Think egg cartons on steroids. There's a company in the Netherlands called Paperfoam that's making injection-molded starch-based packaging that's compostable and surprisingly strong. The load-bearing capacity isn't going to match polypropylene. We're talking maybe 15 to 20 kilos for a Euro-dimension container, but for light to medium storage in dry conditions, it's viable. The material is fully biodegradable, made from industrial starch and cellulose fibers, and the production energy is much lower than plastics. The catch is moisture sensitivity and the fact that the walls need to be thicker to achieve the same rigidity, so you lose some internal volume.
It's that my office is climate controlled and I'm storing cables and paperwork. Option.
It's not going to work in a garage or a warehouse with any humidity, but for Daniel's home office gear, could absolutely work. Natural fiber composites. These are materials where you embed fibers like hemp, flax, jute, or kenaf into a biopolymer matrix. The fibers provide the strength and stiffness, the matrix holds everything together and provides the shape. The advantage is that the fibers are renewable, fast-growing, and carbon sequestering during cultivation. Hemp, in particular, grows like a weed, because it literally is one, and produces strong, long fibers that rival glass fiber for reinforcement in many applications. There are automotive companies already using hemp flax PP composites for interior panels. The mechanical properties for a Euro container application would actually be quite good. Impact resistance, stiffness, weight. That's the rub. Most commercial natural fiber composites today use polypropylene or PLA as the matrix. If it's PP, you're back to fossil-derived plastic, just with less of it. If it's PLA, you've got the brittleness and heat sensitivity problems I mentioned. There's research into using PHA or even lignin-based matrices, but nothing at commercial scale for durable goods. So natural fiber composites are a partial solution. They reduce the petrochemical content and the carbon footprint, but they don't eliminate plastic from the equation.
We're shaving percentages, not solving the problem.
Which is honestly where most sustainability progress happens. A series of 5 and 10% improvements rather than one magic material that fixes everything. But there's one more candidate worth mentioning, and it's the most radical.
I'm braced.
Grown, not manufactured. You take agricultural waste, corn husks, hemp herd, sawdust, inoculate it with fungal mycelium, pack it into a mold, and let the fungus grow through the substrate, binding everything together into a solid shape. Then you heat treat it to stop growth, and you've got a rigid, lightweight, fully compostable material. Ecovative Design in the US has been pioneering this for packaging. They've made protective packaging for companies like Dell and IKEA, ironically.
The IKEA storage replacement grown from the ghosts of old IKEA furniture.
Poetic and not entirely inaccurate. The material properties are interesting. Compressive strength, comparable to some rigid foams, good insulation, fully biodegradable at end of life. But, and this is a significant but, the tensile strength and impact resistance are nowhere near polypropylene. You're not going to stack mycelium Euro boxes 5 high with 50 kilos in each. The material is also sensitive to moisture unless you seal it, and the production cycle is slow, days to weeks of growth time versus seconds in an injection molder.
Mycelium is the check back in 20 years option.
For load-bearing industrial storage, yes. For light-duty decorative storage, it's commercially viable right now. There are companies selling mycelium-based home goods, lampshades, planters, acoustic panels, but a Euro container that can survive a forklift? That's a materials science PhD thesis, not a product.
If we're synthesizing all of this for someone in Daniel's position, needs heavy-duty, standardized, modular storage for home office gear, wants to minimize environmental harm, what's the actual recommendation hierarchy?
I'd say it goes in tiers. Tier 1, the most sustainable option period, buy used industrial Euro containers. You're extending the service life of existing plastic. You're getting the full durability and interoperability of the standard, and your marginal environmental impact is essentially zero. The plastic was already produced. You're just keeping it out of landfill longer. Tier 2, if you need new and want to reduce plastic, look for manufacturers offering high post-consumer recycled content containers with virgin skin co-injection. Schaefer has a line called Ecotech that uses up to 70% recycled material with performance ratings close to virgin. Tier 3, if you're willing to accept lower load ratings and strict environmental controls, molded pulp or wood fiber containers in the Euro footprint do exist and are biodegradable. Tier 4, the experimental tier, natural fiber composite containers, if you can find them, or custom fabricated solutions using materials like Richlite or Paperstone. These are paper and resin composite sheets that can be CNC routed into box forms.
Richlite and Paperstone, those are the materials used for countertops and skate parks, right?
There are a few I'm watching. One is bio-based polyethylene and polypropylene. These are chemically identical to their fossil-derived counterparts, but made from ethanol derived from sugarcane or other biomass. Braskem in Brazil has been producing bio-based PE at scale for years, and bio-based PP is now in pilot production from several manufacturers. But for someone who wants a zero-plastic, high-durability storage system and is willing to pay for it, it's technically achievable.
The short answer to Daniel's, are there intermediate materials? Question is, yes, sort of, with asterisks.
The sustainability win is in the feedstock. You're using atmospheric carbon captured by plants rather than fossil carbon extracted from the ground. The catch is that bio-based PP is currently more expensive and production volumes are small. Any alternative material is going to be worse on at least two of those dimensions, usually cost and performance, sometimes weight and chemical resistance too. The sustainability gain is real, but the trade-offs are real.
There's something almost perverse about that. The material that's best for the job is also the one we most want to move away from.
So bio-based PP is promising, but not a near-term solution for Eurobox manufacturing at scale. The one I find most intriguing is polypropylene loaded with mineral fillers like calcium carbonate or talc. This is already done in some applications. You can replace 30 to 50% of the polymer mass with finely ground mineral powder. Polypropylene is persistent because it's chemically stable. It doesn't biodegrade because nothing eats it, which means it doesn't rot, mold, or break down in storage. Calcium carbonate is limestone. It's abundant, cheap, and has very low embodied energy compared to polymer. The resulting composite has higher stiffness, better heat resistance, and lower polymer content per box.
The Faustian bargain of modern materials, science.
The way out of that bargain isn't obvious. Limestone in a landfill is basically just rocks going back where they came from. The polymer is still the environmental concern. But if you've reduced the polymer content by 40% and the box lasts just as long, that's a meaningful improvement.
Are mineral-filled Euro boxes on the market? Every move generates waste, packing materials, broken furniture, stuff that doesn't survive the transition. Is part of the sustainability win here just that standardized modular storage survives moves better?
They're often marketed as reinforced or heavy-duty rather than eco, but the material reduction is real regardless of how it's labeled. The average household move generates something like 60 to 90 kilograms of waste, a lot of which is storage and organization products that were never designed to be disassembled, transported, and reassembled. That's a fair summary. I'd add one more dimension, which is that the most impactful sustainability decision in industrial storage isn't material choice at all, it's system design.
I've watched particle board furniture disintegrate in real time during a move. It's like watching a sandcastle at high tide.
A well-designed modular storage system that maximizes density and minimizes wasted space has a lower environmental footprint regardless of what the boxes are made of. A Euro container that's been through 100 warehouse relocations is fine. A Billy bookcase that's been through 3 apartment moves is kindling.
The sustainability argument for industrial storage in a domestic context has this hidden mobility dimension. If you're someone who moves, and Daniel clearly is, the durability of the system isn't just about how long the box lasts on a shelf. It's about how many moves it survives.
That's before we even talk about the dollies. Daniel mentioned the standardized dollies, and this is where the system really shines in a moving context. You stack your Euro containers on their dolly, roll the whole stack onto a truck, roll it off at the other end. No packing, no unpacking, no boxes of boxes. The storage system is the moving system. The time saving alone has an environmental dimension. Fewer truck trips, fewer hours of engine idling, less single-use packing material.
The dolly is the unsung hero of domestic logistics.
I will defend that statement. The dolly transforms storage from a static problem to a mobile one. Most home storage is designed on the assumption that things will stay where you put them. Euro containers on dollies assume things will move, between rooms, between buildings, between cities. That design philosophy is fundamentally more aligned with how people actually live, especially renters and people in urban areas where moves are frequent.
Daniel lives in Jerusalem. The rental market there is, let's call it dynamic.
Dynamic is a generous word for it.
He's exactly the use case. Frequent mover, home office equipment, needs stuff to survive the transitions.
It might be about choosing a system that eliminates the waste generated by the moves themselves. If standardized industrial storage prevents him from buying and discarding 3 sets of consumer storage over the next decade, the material question becomes secondary. The avoided waste dwarfs the marginal difference between virgin and recycled polypropylene.
That's a useful reframe. The sustainability conversation usually focuses on the object. What's it made of? How is it produced? Where does it go at end of life? But the system-level question is, does this object prevent the production and disposal of other objects?
That's the essence of what's called avoided burden in life cycle assessment. You don't just count the impacts of the thing you're analyzing, you count the impacts of the things you don't need because you have it. A durable, standardized, reusable storage system avoids the production of disposable alternatives, avoids the waste from moves, avoids the energy and materials of replacement purchases. When you run the full system-level math, the avoided burdens often dominate the calculation.
Which means the most sustainable Eurobox might be the one made of virgin polypropylene that lasts 30 years and prevents 50 other boxes from being manufactured.
It's counterintuitive, but yes, that's often where the numbers land. A virgin plastic box with a 30-year service life and a functional reuse path has a lower per year environmental footprint than a sustainable alternative that needs to be replaced every 5 years. Longevity is its own form of sustainability. It's just not the one that gets marketing budgets.
The slow, boring sustainability of just not buying new stuff.
Which is, incidentally, the least exciting thing you can put on a product label. Buy this once and never think about it again. Doesn't sell like made from ocean-bound plastics or fully compostable. But environmentally, it's often the bigger win.
If we're wrapping this into something actionable, the counsel is, prioritize the standard, prioritize durability, buy used if you can, and don't lose sleep over the plastic if the alternative is shorter lived and needs more frequent replacement.
That's the headline. And if you really want to push the envelope on materials, look at the recycled content offerings from the major European manufacturers or explore molded pulp for light-duty applications. But understand that you're making trade-offs, cost, availability, load rating, moisture tolerance, not getting a free lunch.
The free lunch in sustainable materials remains elusive.
It's been elusive since the invention of agriculture. I don't think industrial storage is going to be the domain that cracks it.
One last question before we wrap. Is there anything on the horizon? Early stage research, lab scale materials that could displace polypropylene in this application in the next decade or two.
The most promising avenue I've seen is what's called bio-based polyethylene and bio-based polypropylene. These are chemically identical to their fossil-derived counterparts. Same polymer structure, same mechanical properties, same recyclability. But the feedstock is bioethanol from sugarcane or corn rather than naphtha from crude oil. Braskem in Brazil has been producing bio-PE at commercial scale for years. Leondo Basel and Neste are working on bio-PP. The carbon footprint is dramatically lower because the carbon in the polymer came from the atmosphere via photosynthesis rather than from underground. And because the polymer is chemically identical, it drops into existing manufacturing and recycling infrastructure without modification.
It's the same plastic, just not from dinosaurs.
Right. Not from fossil carbon. The catch is cost and scale. Bio-PP is currently 2 to 3 times the price of fossil PP, and global production capacity is a rounding error compared to the 60-plus million tons of polypropylene produced annually. But the trajectory is favorable. As carbon pricing expands and biorefining technology improves, the cost gap should narrow. If I had to bet on a material that makes Euro containers sustainable at scale without sacrificing performance, it's bio-based drop-in polypropylene.
Same molecule, better backstory.
Sometimes the most elegant solution is the boring one. Don't reinvent the polymer, just change where the carbon comes from.
There's a metaphor in there somewhere about working with what you have, rather than chasing the perfect alternative.
I think that's probably the deeper theme of this whole conversation. The Eurobox standard is a solved problem. The materials are good enough. The biggest sustainability gains come from using the system as intended. Long service life, reuse, interoperability. Rather than from finding a magical new material, the perfect is the enemy of the good enough that actually works.
The good enough, in this case, is a German-designed plastic rectangle that you can stack, roll, and pass down to your children.
Which is, when you put it that way, a surprisingly beautiful thing.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1888, a prospector named John William Soper discovered a fumarole on the coast of Labrador that produced pure sulfur dioxide gas. No steam, no hydrogen sulfide, just bone-dry SO2 venting at over 500 degrees Celsius. It remains the driest volcanic gas vent ever recorded on Earth.
That's right.
That's unsettling.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps people find the show. We'll be back next week with another prompt from the void.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.